Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for the end of April. It's the 29th, which means that May is just around the corner. And you can see that we are here being videoed in our studio.
You sound so resigned to everything.
It's a virtual video. It's a metaphysical video. There's no video.
Yeah, we were going to do that during our vacation time, but...
But then you just didn't.
Yeah.
You just didn't find the time, did you?
I was gardening almost the entire week until...
It began to rain. So you didn't have time.
And as one of our... Or I guess one of our... No, I think we have a growing audience of...
Of two fans.
One of our listeners asked us who sent me or you that...
That caused the snow, right.
In the end of April.
Yeah. 2 days. Well, so it didn't stick. We should clarify.
But snow was coming out of the ground. You could see, or out of the sky. You could see it falling, and it was.
So we had a fire in the fireplace.
That was ridiculous. We wasted wood that I chopped so that we could sit by a fire.
I'm sorry, it's been really cold, and if it continues to be cold, I'm going to burn all that wood before winter.
We got that. We've never bought a cord in our lives.
But we should. We should be buying them.
And I got that for free, so I thought we should save it for next winter, because every day you want a fire in the winter.
It's cold in the winter, and I want a fire every day.
It's ridiculous.
So I want you to get more
wood. We have a furnace. It blows heat into the house.
But not in a way that...
It's just actual heat coming out of a furnace into the house.
Warms the soul and the mind. So that's what this whole
podcast is going to be. Why is it the things warm your soul and mind are always things that require me working and spending money? Have you noticed that?
What kind of question is that? What?
It always requires my inconvenience.
Yeah. What was the purpose of this podcast? I know we were going to complain about the weather bitterly and angrily.
Well, we don't really have a purpose.
We were going to recap Holy Week for our listener on video. That was a thing that we held out as a promise that we have utterly failed to live up to our own hype.
people were dearly disappointed.
Anxious.
Wait.
I thought
what,
you were
what will Matt
about?
And Anne say about the Holy Week that passed 2 weeks ago? We've kept them on the edge of their seats. It's like the Game of Thrones coming out.
Yeah, this is just like that.
Or the what's the Avenger movie?
The
Endgame.
Yeah.
What will Matt and Ann say about Holy Week?
Well, it could still be relevant because Orthodox Holy Week is right, or Easter was yesterday.
That is true.
So, but they should go ahead and recap theirs because ours is really old now.
So, should we just summarize and say it was a good Holy Week?
It was really great. It was one of the best.
It was one of the best. But more people showed up for things than ever.
Yeah, our attendance was
phenomenal. People drove from an hour away to come to some of this stuff. And no big mishaps.
We didn't burn anything down. Yeah, the timing was pretty great. I should say, I was really anxious about the amount of candles and fire we have right on the heels of Notre Dame. And I kept looking up at our roof, which is made of wood, and just like looking at it and wondering all these things in my heart about how we light a lot of candles on Holy Week.
Although I think that if something terrible were to happen to our building, we have insurance, but two, it wouldn't necessarily be a...
The world would not weep.
Our building was built in like the 50s with corrugated steel and...
It's awful.
And,
in fact...
cinder block construction.
One could say that when our building finally comes to its end, a sigh of relief will come across
the landscape.
The landscape.
Not to say it's not a great gift to have that building.
Oh, it is. It's very good. It's warm.
We would like to renovate the inside, like put some hardwood floor in there, but there's always...
Make it look like a church.
People who need to be fed and things like that, so...
Yeah.
We can't do
We're not going to be spending billions of dollars to fix our building. But we could. We could go for the French way because they're going to... They're not going to do Notre Dame in the Gothic way. They're going to do it with steel and glass.
Really?
And they're going to put a jumbotron along the whole side.
I thought they were just saying... Are they really going to do
that? Well, they're going to have a contest.
Who's the judge of the contest?
Well, Macron and Louis-Philippe.
Oh, that's horrible.
His name. That's his name, isn't Louis-Philippe. What is the Prime Minister of France name?
I don't know.
I feel like it's Louis and something.
Jacques?
No, it's not Jacques.
Pierre.
That's because in Dr. Thorne, the low class person, Mr. Scatchard, names his son Louis Philippe Scatchard after the King of France or something. Okay, so.
Yeah, the only way, but our going back to the fire question, our ingenious assistant figured out a way for the fire to be lit at the Great Vigil with salt and rubbing alcohol.
Yeah, that was pretty.
It was awesome. It went really high, but then it went down like 2 minutes.
He timed it. And it also wasn't full of the glorious smell of
charcoal
and lighter kerosene. Kerosene,
which I used before.
So it was you could smell the incense, which I think sometimes when you do the thing, you light it, the incense you can't smell because of the lighter liquid.
Yeah.
But I had a hard time lighting the candle because it was so aflame. Like it burnt up so high.
Yeah, it was really high. It's cool.
I was a little stressed by that. For the first time ever, I did locate the fire extinguishers before the service.
Right.
The other really nice thing about these is all the details. Some that wonderful person got the flowers this time. I've been the last couple of years going out and buying 20 lily plants, and I'm so allergic to lilies. So what I do in Holy Week is I run to Walmart and I buy hundreds of, well, it's only like 20, but it feels like hundreds. Huh. And then the pollen flies up into my face. And so by Easter morning, my whole face is a red balloon of sorrow. Because you mix that with the incense and I can't breathe and I can't think and I just want to die.
This is supposed to be hypoallergenic incense, wasn't it?
What people say.
I was coughing and...
Well, smoke isn't hypoallergenic. But anyway, somebody else went and bought a lot of beautiful flowers. Not as many lilies, like tulips and hydrangeas and beautiful things. But then carefully cut out all of the little pollen parts so that when I moved the plants around, I did not die of lilies, which was an Easter miracle for me. So that was really wonderful. Wow. It was the little things like that that made all the difference for me this year. So that was my
sad. You know, we were talking about this the other day. I have great sympathy for our Baptist or any non-liturgical fan who's listening to us because Holy Week serves to focus the mind on things like the Atonement and Easter in a way that you don't really get in a non-liturgical.
Hey, your sunrise.
And your whole service. if you're raised in a tradition that has liturgical calendar, this happens for Christmas too. You're focused for 4 weeks on the Incarnation in Advent, and then Christmas comes. You're focused on Christmas for 12 days, and you're focused on Jesus's being revealed in the world throughout Epiphany, and then your whole life has this kind of rhythm focused around Jesus's
own life and work.
In work, yeah. Even it's not something that you necessarily think about all the time, but if you grow up as a kid in that, it's just part of the fabric, and by osmosis.
Well, the answer to that is, well, you should be thinking about the Atonement all the time.
Yeah, but you know, if you're doing your Bible series through Leviticus, through February and March, and then you realize, oh wait, Easter's next Sunday.
I better.
Let me call the Easter Bunny.
Well, then you do the
outfitting crew to get the.
You do the dark on what I love in non-liturgical churches, and I say this with deep affection, is on Sunday, Easter Sunday morning, the doctor's account of the death of Jesus.
Right, we should. Okay,
which
if you're gonna ever do
happen
that,
happen on Palm Sunday.
It should, yeah. If you're gonna do it, do it on Palm
Good
Sunday.
Friday.
Right,
but that's like
you gotta cram in the atonement and in the resurrection
all into one
sermon,
45 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Or 3 points about why it's great that Jesus died and rose again.
Yeah,
with your text as like, you know. Galatians.
Right, right.
Or not an actual account of the resurrection.
But then notice already I can see people gearing up for Sunday, Mother's Day Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because that's not, you know, that is on the non-liturgical church calendar.
That's not.
Mother's Day is now, yeah, what are you going to say on Mother's Day?
No, you shouldn't say anything.
Exactly.
On
you should just.
The Bible's not about Mother's Day. That's not a liturgical moment. You should preach on. That's actually Good Shepherd Sunday. You're supposed to preach on John 10, right? Isn't that always the gospel? You're supposed to talk about how Jesus is the Good Shepherd on this year's Mother's Day.
It's always a minefield on Mother's Day to preach on Mother's Day because you
shouldn't do that because you're gonna.
There are people who are not mothers, people who can't be mothers, people who have lost children. And you're bound to say
people
something.
People who have just lost their mother.
Right.
Like... or who are angry with their mother. It goes both ways. It's right. Both the child and the mother is miserable on Mother's Day, and you should not. Here's all the things you shouldn't do. You shouldn't make any of the mothers stand, like the oldest mother, the mother with the most children, the mother who had never managed to have children, you poor sap. Don't do that. I've heard that in Catholic churches, you're offered... They do this great thing where you can buy flowers from Mother's Day. So all the mothers have to walk by a bank of flowers, and then they can find out how much their family loves them by whether or not they buy an
awesome.
Overpriced flower. So they do a fundraiser for
Mother's
back
Day.
On Mother's Day.
How much in terms of money do you love your mother?
Do you love your mother? Do you want this $10 single rose? Or are you going to walk by it because you don't love her? Even though, like, you may have done beautiful things at home, but she has to walk into church, they would walk by the flowers. They'd be like, oh, I don't...
Should I get a soda?
I want to go to see Avengers Endgame.
Or should I buy a
flower
for my mother?
Mother doesn't love me enough to take me.
So
I'm not going to buy her a flower. So what I do for Mother's Day is I buy a big thing of flowers and I give them to everyone without making eye contact. Just like, here's a flower. I don't even know who you are.
Every female.
I'm not judging you.
Every female of any age.
You're a spiritual mother.
Right?
I don't know. Just take.
But yeah, Mother's Day, every female of any age gets a flower. And on Father's Day, every male of any age gets beef.
Beef jerky.
Yeah.
And then we try not, don't mention it from the pulpit.
What?
Like, don't say, and today... Don't do the thing where you canonize all mothers, and then on Father's Day you castigate all fathers for being bad. That's the thing too.
Yeah, that is right.
Like you on Mother's Day, you're like, mothers are the best. They're so important. They're so wonderful. And then on Father's Day,
man
like,
up, you
jerks.
Get up off the.
I can't believe you.
Why aren't you out there chopping wood for your wife? She's
we
cold.
We don't even have civilization because of your failures. Isn't that what happens?
Yeah, typically. I think I've done that once. When I first
That's
started,
the liturgical calendar. Yeah. That's awful.
Yeah.
No, why don't you preach about a biblical text? I don't know. Or not.
We should just have people who identify as mothers stand up. Men who identify as mothers, please rise and take a flower.
Whoever self-identifies as a mother at
right,
all.
Right.
It's too fraught. No, we're not going to do that.
But there are already people worried about it.
Oh, yeah, I've seen...
Perseverating?
Perseverating. Yeah, yeah, I saw that the Southern Baptists are anxious
because that's on their calendar. Well, I mean, how are they going to fit that in around the sermon series on Endgame? I mean, they've got to preach Endgame now because it's hot.
Oh, yeah.
And that's going to take at least...
Well, But the summer movie series doesn't start until June, probably.
Well, you can't let Endgame go by without exposition and exegesis.
Expositing that text.
Right.
We should find some Endgame sermons.
Have we bridged over into cynicism and sarcasm?
We're now bashing the Southern Baptists and the Catholics in one.
We should stop. Okay. We love
them. We love you.
Please keep listening to us. And send us money.
Please send us money. Fortunately for you, we don't have a way for you to do that, so you can't even click on our PayPal button. Oh, wait. Speaking of money, we should say that you should all come to our art fair.
Yes, yes.
On Friday, all of Good Shepherd's artists, and this is a point where I turned out to be surprised, and I felt bad about my surprise, because when it was said that as a way of helping to pay down the Capitol campaign, we would have an art festival, or on First Friday in Binghamton, we would have we have a whole space. And I thought, Good Shepherd's going to do art.
Well, we didn't know what kind of quality of art we had. We thought we had, like...
Yeah, I thought, like, what are the children making macaroni things? What is this? It turns out, though, that Good Shepherd and Good Shepherd's diaspora has good taste.
Yeah,
thank God. Ability to make beautiful things. So,
it's really amazing stuff. I mean, we're gonna probably get a baptism pool out of the whole thing. It's just really.
I hope so. Yeah, gorgeous. I located a beautiful.
And people who are actually selling their art outside of.
Yes, are going to come and give it as a. So if you wanted to, have a great cause, spend money on a great cause, you could. You could come to our art festival.
However, if you don't want to come to the art festival, you could just send money.
Oh, yeah. I think we should sell the stuff online. I don't know how we would do that.
Well, I think we have to have a right kind of shtick, some kind of selling point.
Okay, so we have so much art
Did you do something really bad last night? Did you
hereby a bowl?
did you break one of the Ten Commandments? Well, send money to our Capitol campaign.
And spring your soul from hell.
Yeah, something like that. Or give $10 to our Capitol campaign and God will give you something.
We'll send you a little handkerchief.
Right, that I prayed over. I have prayed over it. I've sprinkled holy oil on the handkerchief.
No, water.
Okay. Oil. Water, that's right. Well, I was reading Leviticus again yesterday. Because that's my...
As is your want. Won't.
Well, I'm in that. I finished my round of my whole... I finished the Bible for the 25th time.
You say
How
that.
How many times have you read the Bible, yeah?
I've read it a lot of times. I don't keep count.
I finished my 25th reading of the Bible like
it's
a month ago.
It's weird that you would keep count.
2 months ago. And then... It's important that people know how many times I read the Bible. And then yesterday... I'm now in Leviticus. I start the Old Testament over again. And I'm in Leviticus... And
I like how shame is a part of your Bible time. How many times have you read the Bible? It's important for me that I know that I've read it more than you, and that
you probably haven't. I've been a Christian for
I was saying that in a general sense.
Oh, okay.
I was just making fun of you right there. That was a joke.
Well, I just want to be. I've only been a Christian for like since I've been 26, and I'm
so a long time now. Then
25. So how? What's that minus 47?
I don't know.
But in that short period of time, I think I've read. That's more times in a. I've read the Bible more like several. That's at least a year, once a year. Even though that's not my schedule. It's amazing. I amaze myself.
I'm not that amazed. Many Christians read the Bible right over and over again.
Yeah, but not. It's like not with the speed or.
Also, it's not a race. It's just a race through it every year.
How many times have you read the Bible?
I'm not...
you've been a Christian all your life. When's the first time you read all the way through? You know when the first year I read all the way through was? The first year I was saved.
Okay, also, though, you were saved from a lot of bad things. So, I had already memorized whole sections of the Bible by the time you even woke up and found out there was a God.
But now you sleep through it. You like it. You push your little thing, and the guy starts talking, reading the Bible.
Yeah.
And I come in, and like sometimes I can hear you snoring when I give you.
The way that I actually managed to wake up is when I turn on the news, the French news. But I do. I slept through most of the Old Testament in the last month. Okay, what was your point?
You should feel really bad about that.
What was your original point about Leviticus?
Oh, what was my point about Leviticus? Oh, yeah, all the smearing of oil and everything. It's not just the blood. It's smeared on the thumbs and the big toe of the priests.
It's the
and
oil.
The right ear lobe of the priest. It's also the oil. And also you smear oil on all the furniture in the tabernacle.
That sounds
so
fantastic.
All that to say, that's why we should send
oil-soaked
handkerchiefs for people when they donate to our capital campaign. It's biblical.
It's biblical. It's a little bit grotesque.
Maybe I should take a handkerchief up to the pulpit with myself when I preach and when I wipe my head.
Oh, gosh. Okay, I think we should move on. We've done our capital campaign. We've done our Easter wrap-up. What were we going to talk about today?
You suggested books.
We haven't done a book one in a long time.
I know. I just think those might bore people. I don't know.
Well, and this is scintillating, so we didn't read anything interesting this week.
I thought the conversation about how many times I read the Bible was really fascinating.
I know. I could tell that you thought it was great. It's just that I didn't have any articles that I read that I thought were amazing, and there wasn't any news that gripped my attention this week. So I thought that we should do a book wrap-up. But you're disagreeing with me now.
No, I think that's all we've got.
That's all we've got. Okay, well, what have you read lately?
One thing, plugging again, Audible. I don't think I would have read anything in the last 6 months had it not been for Audible, because I guess I'm an Audible learner too. I mean, I learn better by listening than by reading.
That's actually a myth. That's not a thing.
What?
I read that whole thing is totally a myth. It's something that we made up that people just learn, and there's not like all the different kinds of learning.
That's stupid. That's not true.
So that you could learn reading if you wanted to, but you just said you're an Audible learner, and that's because it's for your own convenience.
That's not true.
And if you tried harder, you would be able to learn whatever you wanted to learn.
If you tried harder, but it's easier for me to listen, which means I'm an Audible listener.
No.
Audible learner.
That's just not a thing. But anyway, go on.
Anyway, I was saying I've read, in the last 6 weeks, I think I've read huge books just listening to them while I'm doing other work, like cooking or tooling around in the garden or working out or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can listen, and cleaning, you can listen to just huge swaths of of material. So I got through a book on a big book on Vietnam War, an epic tragedy. I think it was got to figure out who the guy's name was. Max Hastings, who wrote Vietnam, an epic tragedy. It was a really good book. It was by an Englishman. So a lot of the American histories of Vietnam are colored by which side were you on. Were you a hippie or were you a were you in the military or were you a hawk, were you a dev? And Max Hastings, being an English person, doesn't have a dog in the fight. So
Boy, that's a lot of animal metaphors for war. Dove, hawk, and dog.
Yeah. Yes.
I wonder where all those came from.
So it was really good because, you know, a lot of American politically correct histories don't focus so much on the horrible abuses and atrocities perpetrated by the North Vietnamese and by the Viet Cong. They focus on American atrocities, which there were some, but because the media control exercised by the North Vietnamese government, was so great. You know, those weren't as publicized. They were known, but not as publicized. And whereas the American Free Press was able to go in there and just say all kinds of things about everything, which is fine, it's great. But this book was very good about balancing the scales and trying to understand why people did what they did, not just talking about atrocities here, just why people why America invested so much
in that
war, in that time, and why it seemed like a good idea at the time to people,
and then how it shifted.
So it was a really good book. In fact, it and once people even realized that the war was probably not a good investment, how impossible it felt to get out of it once you've kind of invested your prestige, your money, your time, lives.
Yeah.
Getting out was...
explaining to people why it was...
Yeah.
You didn't need to do that anymore. That's...
Right. So, wow. It was a really good book.
How many hours?
I think it's like 49 hours long.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
I think the longest book I've listened to is like 30 hours. I'm about to do... I've started another 30-hour... I don't want to... How do I get away from that? I just started the last chronicle at Barset, which is the last in the Barsetshire series by Anthony Trollope.
What is the Barsetshire series?
It's great. It's churchy. So Anthony Trollope was a postal worker. He rode the train up and down England with the post, or Ireland actually, but he was a churchman, and so the Barsetshire series is a lot of, like, the bishop's name is Mr. Proudie or Dr. Proudie, mm-hmm. and his wife, the bishop's wife, they're horrible people, and, you know, Archdeacon Grantly.
What's it about?
They're novels, so they're all love stories. But all the lives of all the people are intertwined, so there's, like, I don't know how many books, and you see the same characters in each book over and over again. And the writing is fantastic, mm-hmm. brilliant. Funny. So funny and so cutting. Especially about the church. And Pot, you can see he's got his various... like the poverty of certain clergy, the incredible wealth of some clergy and the horrible poverty of other clergy is kind of his thing, and how the church doesn't regulate, doesn't take care of its people, and you can buy your way into certain
What's the
positions.
Time setting again?
1800s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So,
right, because in England a vicar was appointed by the lord of a certain land, right? With the bishop's permission, is that right?
To some degree, but in the town where the cathedral is, you can buy stalls, you can buy posts as an individual, or be given them by the prime minister. So there's a lot of politicking that goes on, right. About who's going to be where. And yeah, you could have a church in your gift, and then how you chose who was going to be there, and then what if he didn't do what you wanted him to do.
This is why in Pride and Prejudice, what's his name?
Mr. Collins.
Mr. Collins is so obsequious toward...
because she's...
the lady, what's her name?
Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
right. Because she's given him her vicarage.
So here's a question. You've read the Bible 25 times, but like now you're wandering your way through. You watched... Pride and Prejudice one time.
No, I bought. No, it's not one time. It's, what do you mean one time? Mm-hmm. If I have seen that six hour marathon once, I've seen it like a million billion times.
I haven't seen it a billion times.
I guess
times.
I watched it with my youth group
you
girls
don't
when I was.
Even know I remember all the
seeing
names
there for.
Of the
I said I remember seeing there like freaking at 2 hours, so, thinking, oh, it must be about over.
You know, like how much
no.
oil gets smeared onto the. Earlobe of the
over.
High priest.
And I told you my pet peeve with that movie. It climaxes with the guy that gets out of the pond. What's his name?
Eli. That's not in the book. There's no pond scene in the book.
I know. What? Every woman I've ever watched the movie with has a sharp intake of breath.
What?
At the moment that he gets out of the pod. That's how I remember that. That scene with. Anyway, he gets out of the guy. That guy finally tracks down the bad guy who's absconded with the 16-year-old.
That is really sketchy.
Right. And you expect there to be some kind of duel. That's what there should be.
There's no duels, though, by that point in English. Like, it's rare. It's rare.
What's the setting?
Well, that's in the 1700s, I think. I don't know.
There were duels.
But not often, and not over something like that. You do everything you can. I mean, that's just not... People weren't always rushing off to have a duel.
Yeah, it would have been a much better story.
But
if there was a fight at the end.
Okay.
And
well,
what's
it wasn't
his name?
Written for you, obviously.
Instead, they get married. He steals the 16-year-old girl.
She runs off.
And then, well, but was she consent?
Yes.
Can she really give consent at 16?
Oh, well, no, she can't. But back then, she totally could. And she wanted to be with him.
Well, yeah, 16-year-old wants lots of things.
It's true.
I mean, what if our 16-year-old wanted to be with a 25-year-old officer?
Yeah, no.
And he absconded with her when we didn't say,
and
okay.
There would be a duel.
If you can marry her, we give her to you.
Yeah. Well, they had to pay him to marry her.
Right.
But the family name was spared.
Yeah. And that's the most important.
Well, you can't read it backwards like that. That's terrible.
I just deconstructed your whole world, didn't I?
Okay, well,
I'm sorry, we got off your book.
I've been in the world of Barset for a long time, and I haven't read any other things lately. Like, I've been sitting not listening to Augustine's Confessions, because I don't like the reader, and I also have not been listening to the Divine Comedy. But I did read A Man Called Uwe, and I loved that. It was an interesting book, A Man Called Uwe.
Is that your review?
That's my review. It was really great. It's good.
What was it about?
A Man Called Uwe.
What did he do?
Here's where it's interesting, because it starts out and he's really, he's in an iPad store trying to buy a piece of technology, and he's being a real jerk. And then it unfolds from there. You realize that he's trying to do away with himself desperately because his wife has died. And as you go on, you see this guy who's really mean and difficult is actually in horrible grief. And so the layers slowly come off. I thought it was a great... Because it's a helpful image for the church. You know, people come in and you're like, what is going on? And then you gradually get to know them and realize, oh, they're like that because that really terrible thing happened to them. Or, you know, they got that, they picked that burden up along the way. But it's told really well. There's a lot of application for the church in A Man Called Uwe, even though it's not a Christian book. So you can read that also instead of reading the Bible. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. You should still read the Bible. I've also been reading a lot of stuff about African traditional religion.
Because you're writing an article.
You're
writing a paid article for this.
I'm getting paid to read about African traditional religion. And I did just read something really good on that. If you're really interested in the subject of African traditional religion, I did just read, it's not coming up, Foundations of African Traditional Religion and Worldview. Really good book. Excellent. So I think
we were talking about it last night. We had an actual good conversation next to the fire that I stoked.
You stoked the fire, and we talked about whether God in African traditional religion is transcendent or immanent, or whether that's a Western category that when you try to wrap your mind around an African conception of God, are you taking that Western sort of binary view and imposing it, because Africans are not really, I would say they're not polytheistic. Just to generalize the entire continent, that's the thing that's hanging me up. To write this chapter, I'm going to have to generalize the whole continent with millions of different
aspects,
people and thousands of languages and culture. We're just going to go ahead and say Africans think this about God.
Well, it's kind of like trying to write a book about Hinduism. I mean, you've got so many different variations of Hinduism, right? Is that the kind of same thing?
Or Buddhism. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different manifestations of... I'm wrapped up in my own world about whether God is... if there's a sort of polytheism. I don't think there is. I think that Africans, by and large, are monotheistic.
That's right.
There's one God, and there's not the Buddha or the Hindu sense that everything is one and God is in everything. But there is a deep connection. I read somebody called it holism, that everything is connected, but God isn't in everything. And if there's a jinn in a tree, that tree isn't the jinn. When you cut the tree down, you're not cutting down the jinn. You're hurting the jinn by destroying
You're just messing up his house, right?
Yeah. If you know, if our listener knows a lot about African traditional religion and wants to correct me at any point, they should go ahead and private message me.
Yeah.
But that's the world I've been in. It's not very fascinating, and I can't blog about it. I think it's fascinating, but... as I've been reading more and more, I haven't been, I've been also grasping at things to write about on my blog that might feel more relevant to the, you know, internet, the interwebs. So that's why I'm behind on my reading. I'm also reading.
You've had three books in a row, can I say that?
Oh, okay, go ahead. I have two more. You can have another one.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I wrote read another book by Max Hastings, same guy who wrote the Vietnam stuff on World War II, just an overview of World War II, which is really, really good, a 50-hour book. I read a book by, it was a biography of Napoleon by Andrew Roberts. Really good stuff, too. I'd read a book on the Revolution before... or listened to a book on the Revolution before, but this book on Napoleon was excellent. And it was more, you know, you kind of have this sense of Napoleon being kind of a comic figure a little bit, the short man with a big hat ordering things around. But he really wasn't, one, he wasn't that short compared to people of his day. And two, he was a really brilliant man. He was considered, he was not a joke. Of course, I guess we all know that. Anyway, he said he's knows he wasn't a joke, but the caricature we have of him in our modern day.
I mean, history is won out by making him look stupid.
Right. But he was ambitious, smart.
I know. How do you become the emperor of a country?
Yeah,
right after the French Revolution, right, without having some Huckley.
Right. and kind and. In his own way.
In his own special way.
Right. But he give him credit for blunting the sharpness of the Revolution. I mean, when he came in, he restored order and law in a way that the radicals had destroyed it in France. So his was a... He really, I think, saved France from becoming... anarchy.
Destroying itself.
Yeah, destroying itself, right, exactly. He restored the church, he restored nobility, he restored the rule of impartial law rather than revolutionary law. Mm. So it was fascinating history. Then I started reading...
you read a book on Washington.
Yeah, I just finished a book on George Washington, which was... who was that by? Oh, yeah, this is by the same guy who wrote that Alexander Hamilton book. Chernow, I think his name. Let me see, find it here.
Loves him.
Yeah, Ron Chernow. So, yeah, I can see why they love him, because he's a great writer. And I had always been bored to death by George Washington because I remember when I was a...
George Washington cut down the cherry tree.
Yeah, or just the morality tales you get told when you're a kid, which was not true. He told several lies. He told a number of lies.
Well, he was a spy.
Huh?
Wasn't he a spy in the French and Indian War?
No, he was a... No. Oh. But he was really interested in espionage.
So that's all about lying.
No, but he was... Yeah, well, he was a general of the Continental Army during the Revolution. And he wasn't that great of a general. I mean, he didn't make any brilliant tactical or strategic moves. But he was in it. He was just relentless. He held the army together, and in a revolution like that, when you're fighting forces that are based in England, it has to be logistically provided for. What you need is a general who's going to be able to play the long game.
Yeah.
And wear the other side out, and that's kind of what ultimately happened. It turned out to pay a lot of attention to Washington's really mixed. It was one of the most interesting aspects of it was Washington's ownership of slaves. He inherited some, and he ultimately had about 150 slaves on his plantation. But he refused to sell a man or a woman if they were married. So his policy was he wouldn't break up families. He wouldn't buy or sell away from a family. And he hated... He had this moral battle going on throughout his entire life about whether he should free slaves or not. Huh. He knew he should, but he didn't see how he could maintain his level of life without them. And he felt duty-bound to keep them for his family's sake and for Martha's sake. And and so in his will, he freed them all. In his will, it stated, after Martha goes away,
they all
go free.
Didn't he end up, because he wouldn't sell people away from it, didn't he end up with a lot, like a whole village?
Yeah, basically? He had this huge number of slaves because he wouldn't call by selling them. Ultimately, he realized, having as many slaves might be convenient for us, but it's economically not a great way to do things. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't, to change it would require a revolution in his own.
In his own, wow.
But... So he knew it was wrong, but he couldn't stop doing it. He wouldn't stop doing it. And so he had this... And he did some pretty bad things. He chased down slaves of his that ran away. He sold some... He would never whip them, but what he would do is he would sell them to... Bad slaves he would sell, or quote-unquote bad slaves, he would sell to...
Harsh.
No, to a company that would send them down to Haiti or somewhere to where it was probably ensured that you were not going to live,
because
it would work you to death. So he was by no means guiltless. It was just the moral conflict of the Washington went through.
It was That's interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah, he was a Virginia planter. I mean, everyone had slaves, and but his freeing of them when he died, he was hoping would set off a kind of, we should do that too.
Oh,
but it didn't.
But it really didn't.
Right. And I didn't know how much in the during the Revolutionary, after the war, slavery was already a hot issue. People were already thinking, even some Southerners were saying we should free them, some were saying we shouldn't. The North was very much in favor of manumission and a revolution. And
so from the get-go, there was a...
Right.
A problem that's interesting. I didn't know that either. So it wasn't something that just sort of grew up suddenly by the time of the Civil Mm-mm. War. It was there.
It was part of the Constitution's designed to figure out how to keep the nation together, even though they disagree about this thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Wow. Well, now you're reading
Churchill, who was a jerk.
Yeah.
As a young man. It's kind of interesting. I'm reading this at the same time I'm reading Woodhouse to the kids at night, mm-hmm. As a part of our family devotion.
Well, I wouldn't have called it that, but.
And this biography of Winston Churchill is by Andrew Roberts, and it's very, very, very good, as so far. But it's as a young man, he was He was a cavalry officer.
But he lived in the time of Galahad Threepwood.
Right.
He was a glittering part of the
Right, I can see 90s. Him. I can see him, if Galahad Threepwood were not a fictional character, being that Winston Churchill would be part, flung. A big part of his book of reminiscences.
Reminiscences. Rubbing, being thrown out of the mottled oyster.
And right. Because apparently it was in late 90s of the 19th century, and there was this theater where, I guess, dancing girls were. And behind the theater, there were all these restaurants and bars.
Dolly Henderson, where, if you're wondering.
Where after the show, the elite aristocratic men would mingle with women who were not so.
And that's how you got every plot of every Blandings.
Right. So some of the ladies of London were so horrified by this that they built a partition between the theater and the bar area, and they forbade women from entry, of whatever class, could not enter into the bar area. Men had to be there by themselves. And so Winston Churchill,
the whole point of the bar,
led a revolution. In his 20s, I think it was. Maybe in his late teens, but they tore down the partition.
Tear down this wall.
And his first political speech apparently was standing atop the battlements that he'd just torn down, saying, "Ladies, what we do for the empire."
That's all.
Yeah, it was funny.
So. That's awesome. Well, I'm excited because I finally got... I've been reading A Piece to End All Peace for 20-plus years. And by that, I mean it's been sitting here and I haven't actually been reading it, but I've always wanted to, but everything comes in the way of it. And I've been checking on Audible for a while every now and then. I check to see if A Piece to End All Peace is there. And it finally is, David Fromkin. I've read half of this book, but I'm going to listen to the whole thing. And Churchill figures largely.
And that,
and again, it's a fascinating thing because it stands out. It sorts through all the terrible problems of communication. So when you're making a treaty with another country, and you don't speak the language, and they don't speak your language, you end up, and then everybody has their, you know,
their own ideas,
their own agenda, and what they think should happen, you just have a potentially devastating situation, which did come about. I think it's in the period between the two wars. Can't remember exactly, but I'm excited for that book. I'm saving it.
You found it on Audible?
Yeah, it's now on Audible. If you have a hard time reading long history books, it's only 23 hours, so I'm excited to finally finish it after 20 years. The other thing I'm reading that I love, you're reading Important Things. I am halfway through Neil Gaiman and Cherry Pratchett's Good Omens. And as soon as I finish it, I'm going to watch the thing on Amazon, because they just put out a series. And what's so funny about this is that it just begins in the Garden of Eden, where the angel who's supposed to be holding the flaming sword to keep Adam and Eve out of the garden hands it off to somebody. Or no, he hands them the sword as they leave because he thinks they look like they'll need it. And then it goes on from there. We're in the middle of the apocalypse. It's the day the world is ending. I think it's going to be Saturday.
Have you heard the movie's good or no?
I think so, Saturday. I mean, the day Saturday. So it's the week of the apocalypse. And then the Antichrist, the angels in charge of grooming the Antichrist from birth up, accidentally mix him up with another little boy. And so
they can't figure out where
he
is.
And the Hound of Hell ends up being a little fluffy dog. Because that's what the little boy wanted. When the Hound of Hell comes running towards him, he imagines that he's always wanted a dog, a puppy. And so the Hound of Hell is as surprised as everyone else. Really funny, brilliant writing. It's so sad that Terry Pratchett died. But I think that after I've read it, we should watch that together, because I think it's good. I think it got good reviews. Yeah, that's my very important reading.
That's awesome. I like that.
Oh, well, I think as a way of concluding this important cultural moment of our time podcast, we should say why reading Woodhouse to children as their bedtime story is the best thing ever. I mean, you're enjoying it.
I am enjoying it. I didn't think I would. I don't like frivolous reading.
I feel like
it's but it's not, really not, because it teaches...
It teaches more important lessons to young people.
Right.
Such as, don't go marrying a dancing girl and ruining your family's escutcheon. Okay, what I like about Woodhouse, as I'm listening to you read it every night, and it's important that you read it, because as soon as I start reading, you fall asleep. So I refuse to read the books out loud. You have to read them. But what I'm enjoying this time around, because I've read all these books, is that the female characters, the whims and fancies of the females in Woodhouse's world drive every single plot forward.
They are the ones who have all the cards. They're how they want to proceed is how things proceed, and the men are like, they're all just like.
Like what?
I don't know. Some of them are
they're good and solid. Bad.
are solid, but some of them are.
But you have to negotiate your way through a dizzyingly complicated world of the whims of the Châtelaine, the horrible aunt who is worried about the family's reputation.
Right.
But also. So what I like is you see in a funny and charming way how terrible it is when women get to rule the world. That's one thing. The other thing that I love is that the way he describes a young man in love or the beauty of a female person mm-hmm. is so... nice. It's for one, it's not it, there's no whiff of sexuality about it, so you're in the
play. Well, there is the, his face was flushed,
yes,
when he saw
clasped
her.
Him to herself himself
right but it's very chaste
sexuality. It's very chaste. It's a little it's ridiculous, so it's funny. It takes the horror of it away. The ideal, the idyllic world that Wall calls Woodhouse's world, it is idyllic in that it doesn't exist, but it sort of exists. You know, like, it should exist in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's a graciousness about it that ought to be there.
What I like about the women there is the way there's a... The friendship between a man and a woman is not sexualized, which is
that's
it
right.
tends to be in lots of books, even you know, comedies, whatever. It's there's actual men and women who are just friends, who respect each other, like each other, may even think that the other person is handsome or pretty, but there's not
a that sexual overtone to it. That doesn't mean that they have to suddenly rush off and marry that particular person.
Right.
Yeah, there's a camaraderie that's really nice.
Which I think is helpful for teenagers to see that.
Yeah.
Because everything they see now in male-female relations is totally sexualized.
Yeah.
Even, you know, in the church, when you hear people talk about male-female relationships, it's almost always in the context of sex, not friendship. And so it's nice to
or
have
marriage
that modeled in a kind of interesting way.
Funny, yeah. In a funny story.
Yeah.
The other thing that I like... Well, first of all, I think that A Damsel in Distress is one of Woodhouse's absolute best. If you haven't read, if you only confined yourself to Jeeves and Wooster, you're wrong. You need to read all the Blandings books. But also, A Damsel in Distress, but there's also the Smith books are really wonderful. But A Damsel in Distress is masterful. And then the thing that I like about men in many of the Woodhouse books, the female characters are... very strong and terrible. But then you also have the often a young man in love who's trying to get to be with a woman. He's having to take a lot of action. He's not sitting by passively. He has to deal with fate, and so there are real male characters, usually young, who have to act, and they're not, they can't, and they're contrasted against Percy, you know, horrible young men who are
Percy Pilbeam
and who are awful.
Right, right.
So you have good and evil sketched out in, I think, a really helpful different way that I'm noticing as I'm watching our...
It's hilariously funny.
Our children are just dying with laughter every night, which is great. Even the little kids are...
getting it.
Getting it. So that's our bedtime reading. I'm writing those books down. I'm trying to get up to 60 books this year, and I'm on track. I'm meeting my monthly target, even with really long books, 30-hour books. I'm meeting my monthly tracking by including all the Woodhouse books that we're reading at night.
Yeah.
So, well, I think we've probably talked about that a long time.
We've lost our listener, I'm sure.
We've lost our listener. We should conclude this special time together and go on about our lives.
So I'm not going to promise we're going to film this next week, but we're going to make a college try.
You keep saying, but then it's you that doesn't have time.
It's not just me.
It's pretty much you, though. I've asked, like, did you want to do that? And then you say yes, yes, and then there's no time. What with your gardening responsibilities? So.
Yeah. Requirements.
Requirements. Which they are. So. Well, thank you for listening. If you don't want us to talk about books again next week, somebody's better tell us
something. Ask us a question or something. Give us something to talk about.
Yeah, our listener needs to send us a question. Until then, have a great week.